What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 103 of The Locker Room. We got a great guest today in Stan Fischler, the longtime NHL writer, author, and Hockey Hall of Famer. Had a great time talking to him. Right now, I'm joined with Brett Hamfling, Al Addis is back, and Justin Kapelmaster. Going to talk Super Bowl, some Valentine's Day, Tinder Swindler, Olympics, all the above. But who do I want to kick it off to here? Let's start with the Super Bowl. And Al, I know you won a couple Super Bowl bets. Let's start with you. How'd your Super Bowl night go?
Actually, I did not, Johnny, but I did not come away a loser. And let me tell you, I had Rams 3, Bengals 0. So I was the guy who was
like in the boxes?
The boxes.
So wow.
I took halftime and full game.
Yeah, you cleaned up.
We had a guy like that too on our team. Unbelievable. It's shit's rigged.
Somebody made out like a bandit. So that was me. So I made a little money on the Super Bowl.
What'd you come away with? Don't be shy.
I made $1,400.
Holy shit. That's
yeah, Super Bowl.
Not bad. $20 a box.
Your eyes must have lit up too when you got 3-0. That's the best numbers you can get.
Honestly, we were drinking heavily, and I think I played 10 games of 21 Cup.
Oh, yeah. I'll get you.
So by the time the game started, I was like gone. So by the time the halftime hit and the end of the game, I was wiped out. I was laying on the ground. I was just like watching. And I'm like, oh, nice. I'm like, cool.
And it would have never hit if that extra point wasn't botched in the first quarter, which is funny.
True.
But speaking of you being dead, that's a rookie move. You know, we have this every year. You know how it goes. Or I know how it goes. I've been there most years too. But I've sort of learned to pace myself, both drinks and the food. You don't want to chip yourself to death with the chips and guac and salsa before the real food comes out. You know, it's a real art to these type of events, especially the Super Bowl.
You're so right. And I literally, in the middle of like game three, like looked at the TV and like saw that the game was like 2 hours away. And I was like, I'm like, you're doing it. You know what you're like about to do. Like, you've been here before. And like, I just freaking did it. You know, when you're winning,
you can't hop off.
You can't leave the table when you win six in a row. You gotta stay. So
I've actually never drank on Super Bowl Sunday. I strictly eat. I'm not good at the drinking and the eating combined. It's never been good for me. But even when I go out like on weekends, like I don't like going to dinner before going out because I get too full and I'm paying like $20 for a drink and I'm not even getting drunk because I'm eating so much. So I go out, I like to keep it light, have like, you know, maybe a slice of pizza or something. And then, you know, that this way I get drunk easier and I spend less money.
All right. I think you have to grow up. I get the money thing. I get the money thing. But okay. So first of all, you got to have a before dinner drink. That's 101.
This is Super Bowl or this is going out now?
No, just going out to dinner. You have a before dinner drink. It could be in your apartment. So money wise, you have a, I don't know what you drink.
Tequila.
You have a tequila, you have a beer, one, maybe two. Then you get to dinner and you have one and you're feeling pretty good. You can have another if you want. You don't have to go crazy. And so when you're mixing, I get if you like do a full meal and then start drinking. I mean, I can, I'm not a bitch, I get the sentiment that it's tough to go food then drink.
Yeah, very tough.
But Super Bowl's the Super Bowl of that situation. So you kind of just gotta power through and man up.
Not me. I'm weak.
I'll take you to it next year.
This was low-key the first Super Bowl where I wasn't able to like actually like watch the commercials and like the extra stuff that happened for like the first half because we were out at like a bar and like the TVs were just blasting. So I really didn't get to focus on that. And I was kind of pissed. What I did glimpse on, like some of them were actually unreal. I thought like a few of them were good. The one where Jefferson hit the gritty, like they're like cartoon characters, I thought was great. There was a couple other ones, but I actually went on YouTube and like typed in like Super Bowl commercials after because I wanted to watch them. Because like, I mean, I don't know. They are like, I feel like they are so special, but I feel like the main reason why they're so special is because there's like celebrity like casted like so much, dude, every fucking commercial.
It's also one night a year where like, it's you're only, you know, you're required to just care about commercials, like literally, you know, one out of 365 days. And I like my favorite one, and got to give a shout out to one of my best friends, Jack Roberts. He works for FTX. The Larry David commercial I thought was awesome. Like that was one of the best ones.
It was, but like Cappy said, so I was with a bunch of people, and you know, you can't really get people. You can't be the one to get people shushed down the commercials. Yeah. I feel like years ago, Larry David did, but I feel like years ago we did that. But so I saw Larry, I knew it was funny. I was kind of watching, I was trying to hear, but I, I did the same thing. I went next day. I Googled best Super Bowl commercials. Because I'm not going to be the one that doesn't understand what's going on, whether it's Larry, Austin Powers, or I don't know.
Austin Powers was great. I didn't even think about that one. That was classic.
It was great. It was perfect.
What about the Coinbase one? The Coinbase one was the winner.
Was that
the Coinbase was genius. Yeah. Their app crashed after.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like originally I thought like our TVs at the bar just like crashed. Like I didn't know what the fuck was going on. I'm like, there's like seven people in the bar like, hey, figure it out. And then like you go on Twitter and everyone's like got the picture of the barcode. I'm like, fuck.
Dude, meanwhile, I got completely teased. GoPuff and Lil Dicky partnered for like a quarter time show. And like Brett, I was you in the situation. So I was saying like one of my friends, Ben, was like, let's clean up the wings after the first quarter and, you know, make room for whatever's next.
That's a rookie mistake anyway.
I was like, dude, I'm not cleaning. Like Lil Dicky's quarter time show is on. Like I'm watching it. And then little do I know, nothing comes on TV. And Lil Dicky just like posted the video on Instagram and YouTube. I was like, I thought it was gonna be on TV. I was like so hyped to see him on TV.
All right. So I only knew about that because of you reposting on Twitter. Uh-huh. But I assumed the whole way that was just a social first thing.
Really? I didn't think at all.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was going to be an actual quarter time show. Damn. I was like, all right, he's going to do
something. Well, not like live in the stadium. No, yeah, no. I didn't think it'd be maybe in the
stadium. Outside the stadium or something like that.
But then that means he's paying for that as opposed to, I don't know.
Well, it was GoPuff. It wasn't him. It was through GoPuff.
It could have been. But was it good, Johnny? I never ended up watching it.
It was like funny. It was like a 4-minute like kind of clip, which could have been in like the show Dave. Like, you know, it wasn't really him like performing. It was more so like a kind of like a skit or a bit. But I enjoyed it.
I can't get through a 4-minute clip anymore.
Yeah, you need TikTok 30 seconds. What cap?
No, since I'm an avid Dave of aficionado of the show now. Did you see that what he tweeted?
Season 3?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
So I mean that'll be pretty exciting.
Well, it's not official. They just said like retweet this if you want
to. Oh, yeah. Of course. But when it happens, I'm putting the good vibes out there. I'll be pretty excited for it. Mm-hmm.
So you guys like that show? I know you've been back and forth on it a little bit.
Not even back and forth. No, Laz was just so high up on it. And like, it was just kind of one of those shows where like every week when we had the podcast, Laz was talking about it. And like, I just still didn't watch it. And nobody was watching it except Laz. So he had nobody to relate to.
I thought you didn't like the first few episodes of the season or something, Laz.
Yeah, the first 3 episodes of season 2 were a little dark, but then it picked up and got really good. I mean, I rewatched them and it wasn't that bad, but you know, definitely not like the best episodes of the show.
While we're on the topic of shows, because we love talking about this, I know we talked about the Tinder swindle. I don't know if you watched it yet, Laz.
Yeah, it sucked. I hated it. I want to pick a bone with Brett.
We'll do that first, and then I'll recommend another show that I just started on here.
Okay, deal. Brett, what do you got?
Well, I was about to say, good thing you didn't give up on Dave after the first couple episodes that you didn't like you did on the Tinder swindler.
That's true. That's true. Fair enough.
So for those who don't know, so I tweeted something about the Tinder swindler partnering up with Billy McFarland, who's the kid from Firefest, who's in jail, but he'll be out soon, about like scheming together and starting a party planning company. And Laz chimes in on Twitter. He says, I don't really like Tinder swindler. He said something about it being slow. And I said, there's some merit to that. There was maybe minutes. I think I said 15 to 40 weren't told great. They're a little slow, but the last hour was just electric thrill ride. Laz did not watch the last hour.
No. Well, I watched the first hour. I think it was like an hour and 45 total, right? Something like that. I watched the first hour, but dude, the story was definitely interesting. And it like what kind of I thought was like cool at the time was when they showed like the picture of like the dad and mom and how he was in the picture, but I guess he cropped himself in and then they like take him out of the picture.
That's when it starts to all fucking crash.
Yeah. So I watched the next 10 minutes and I was like, oh, like this was the turning point. But even then I still was like, the way they're telling this is so boring.
The way they were telling it with the woman, with both women in the beginning was a little slow, but the last hour was a thrill ride. Have you guys watched it?
But I'm going to watch it just based on what you're saying right now.
It's really wild. It's not giving anything away. You know, this dude, basically, you know, I'm not giving it away.
I heard a little bit, so you can.
The name also gives it the name of the thing gives it away.
Like, yeah, I was told a little bit about it, so you can elaborate a little.
He created this sort of alternate persona online, not just on this dating app on Tinder, but like his entire life, pretty much. And you know, he goes on dates with all types of women and flies them across the world, and you know, portrays this life, and it just. isn't exactly as it seems. that would be the trailer.
Yeah, that was not how that was seen. Just as bad as the actual thing.
Thank you.
I was going to say, if you haven't seen the Tinder Swindler, fast forward those last 30 seconds. So Brett didn't give anything away.
He didn't give anything away anyway.
Well, it's too late now. It's too late now.
That's what I heard. All right, sweet. Yeah,
if you haven't seen it, go back. You just listen to this, but if you get to this and Cappy says it now, go back and then fast forward through it.
Laz, you 100% need to watch Firefest, though. That's a lock. I will swear by that documentary. That's something
that's just great.
One of the craziest things when it originally came out. Also, I'm not a big Netflix guy anymore because I'm blessed that I have like Hulu and HBO Max and all this big time shit, I guess, when it comes to streaming networks.
You're so blessed that you pay for it.
So blessed that I use Baby Girls.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
But there's a new show on Netflix called Inventing Anna. I started it last night. It's pretty trippy, and it's kind of cool. It's like unique. I'm not going to give anything away, but it's number one on Netflix right now. That's something you should go check out. It's like season, 8 episodes.
People are at least talking about it in the same conversation as Tinder Swindler.
Not watching it then.
Nothing to do with the Tinder
Swindler. Dude, I also swear, Cap, you go through a show every week we hop on here. You got like two new shows that you've seen.
Who, me?
Yeah, that's you're like, stuff. Yeah, you watch, how many shows do you watch a week?
No, it's not even that. It's like I'll get into bed and I'll just throw on something and then I'll fall asleep and I'll wake up and I'm like three episodes ahead and then I just have to like go back and figure out what I missed and stuff like that. But that's like what that's more so.
How does
what
that help?
But no,
I thought you just say you wake up and just keep going from wherever you are. So that's how you bust through shows.
Hockey's a weird schedule, boys. You mean,
he's on the road.
That's true. A lot of downtime.
That's actually
you're working out and you're skating during the mornings and stuff like that. And the afternoons, you know, are kind of open. But I really don't watch any Netflix or anything during the afternoon. It's literally at nighttime. I'll just throw something on, like I said. But I don't know. It could be a little weird. But I don't know. Have you guys ever done that? Like, I feel like that's the worst. Like, you put a movie on, you put a show on, you fall asleep, like while it's still on, and you wake up and you got to like retrack where the fuck you remembered where you like left off.
Of course, but actually I don't really fall asleep during things. That's just me. I feel like you're either a person who does or you're a person who never does. Like there's some people you put a movie on, first 10 minutes, they're out every time.
Movie's different. I'm watching a movie thorough, like regardless of if it sucks, like regardless of if it's like Tinder Swindler quality. Yeah,
I'll shut it off, but I'm not going to sleep.
There should be something though. Like my best friend Henry a couple years ago, like when everyone like kind of watched Netflix on their laptop before you can kind of stream it on a TV, he said like they should have a thing you can implement to Netflix where you just click on the S like on your computer, like when you're watching a show, so it can like track where you started to like doze off, like S for sleep, I guess. You know, so this way when you like wake up the next day, you can kind of go back to where you felt yourself dozing off, so you can pick up right from there, which I thought was an amazing idea. I don't know what you can do like if you're watching it on TV, but there should be something like that for every streaming service where you can kind of like, you know how Netflix always asks like, are you still watching?
Yeah,
there should be something where like you feel yourself dozing off.
I'm literally picturing videos of like you're gonna click it, but you don't.
Even when even when you're with a boyfriend, girlfriend, or with someone like after a date, and you're like, not to say I hate like the Netflix and chill thing, but if you're like laying in bed watching a show or movie with somebody, and you know things happen, things escalate. You want to go back to where you kind of left off.
Netflix and chill thing. Now you're a big Netflix and chill guy now.
Not true.
Yeah.
Well, I was gonna say that's the other joke, the other meme. Are you still watching? And then it's like her, and it's just something.
What is it?
Yeah, I've seen this.
That's actually one of the best things. Pete Davidson. Have you guys seen Pete Davidson stand up on Netflix? I think.
Mm-mm. No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I was at the actual
Kanye show.
Well, this is like 2 years ago, but I was at the actual like live performance when Pete was doing the stand up for the Netflix special. And he said like to the crowd, all right, guys, this next part's just for the Netflix part. Like, I'm just going to say it and like go along with it. And it was like funny to watch on Netflix, like, you know, a year later when it came out. But he said like, did you guys just start fucking? And then like, you know, like he's saying that like to the people watching on Netflix. And then like 10 minutes later, he goes, you're still fucking? You're fucking again? You know what I mean? It was kind of like funny to like be there. Like, when he was saying like, all right, guys, just 1 second. This is just for like Netflix purposes. It's kind of like funny. I don't know.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. He's great, honestly. His stand-up's really good.
Transitioning off the movies and shows, which we got a lot of recommendations. Big UFC card this weekend. Al, I'm sure you caught it. Israel Adesanya reclaimed the belt again over Whitaker. Just such a weird fight, though. That's like kind of what I wanted to talk to you about, Al, too. And I mean, if you guys watched it, but, like, I know we talked about it previously about the judging and boxing and UFC fights. Like, it's just so fucking annoying. Like, I would just want to know who's up after each round, so you know, like, going into the next round, what you got to do, because the fight was so like standstill. I feel like Whitaker, if Whitaker made a note knowing that he was down more, he would have done more to maybe knock out Adesanya. But the thing is, Adesanya is so good and so dangerous that he might not have wanted to do that. Regardless, Adesanya claimed that one. And obviously the co-main event, Tui Tavalosa, whoever you pronounce his name, did the shoey, knocked out the greatest knockout artist of all time. Was amazing to see that. And his walkout song, I don't know if I sent it to you guys, was all fucking time. Girls just want to have fun. I was like, this guy is destined to win this fight.
I think it was a pretty good card overall. For me, like, the main fight, the Adesanya fight, was just yawn for me. I mean, there was nothing going on in the fight. I think it was my brother's a big Bobby Knuckles fan, but, and I actually bet on Robert Whittaker, but, you know, he just didn't have enough to really challenge Adesanya. And it just shows you that there's no one in the division that can right now, other than Khamzat Chimaev, who's the up and comer from like Dagestan, I believe. I don't know where, I think he's from wherever.
Dagestan? Is that a real place?
I think he's from wherever Nurmagomedov was from.
Johnny, don't piss off our Dagestan listeners.
Yeah, sorry.
he's from somewhere out there, you know.
Dagestan's a republic in Russia.
Yes, I think you're right now.
I'm pretty sure he's from there. He's an absolute. I've watched him fight. He's the guy in the division who'll give Adesanya a real fight. So that's exciting. And then, like you said, the Tui Voss fight was surprising, and that guy is one of the, you know, he's got to get a main event. I mean, people love him. He does a shoey. You guys know what a shoey is, Laz? And
no clue, dude. Right? I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
After he wins, there's this big guy from, I think he's from like New Zealand maybe, or Australia. And he's in the heavyweight class, 265 pound guy. And he's really good. And he just knocked out the number two or three contender in the heavyweight division. And he was like,
most 11. Knockouts in UFC history, he knocked the guy out.
Yep. And after he wins, he does what they call a shoey, and he pours a beer in a shoe.
Oh, so yeah, I know that. Okay.
Out, so on the way out, he'll like literally just stop off. People have a shoe, pour a beer, and he'll go to the next person, do one. Like, he's a fucking complete party. Like, it's great for the sport. It's great for, I love it, you know?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, and also, like, speaking of the beer thing, I'm not a huge golf fan either, but seeing all the beers thrown on that hole in one at the, what tournament was that? The
Farmers Open, I think?
It's the Waste Management.
Waste Management. That was awesome.
Scottsdale, yeah.
That tournament turned into Nassau Coliseum after game six of the playoffs last year. That was sick.
Yeah, so it's the biggest party tournament every year, but not every year they have hole-in-ones. They actually haven't had one in 7 years, I think. To see them throw beers on like a quaint, you know, respectable sport as golf is just insane. It's awesome. And I love the people who are pissed off about it because they're stuck up and
they're no fun.
Old golf tradition. Listen, that's not going to be happen at the Masters, but, you know, one tournament every year, it's awesome.
Man, it was crazy. Last year we played Arizona State. I don't know if I mentioned this, and it was the same weekend as that tournament.
Oh, really?
It was the biggest shit show up in that town, like up in that whole state. Like, it was just bumping. Like, the atmosphere was bananas. And on Sunday after our last game, we actually got tickets to go there if we wanted to. It started off with the senior class down to the freshmen. We only had like a certain amount of tickets. And our senior class ended up just going bar hopping in downtown, which like was the best time regardless. But a bunch of people went to that tournament and they were like, it was amazing. They all said it like was great.
Well, I heard next year that tournament falls on Super Bowl Sunday in Arizona. So it's Super Bowl weekend and Waste Management in the same weekend next year in Arizona. That could be a fun trip to go to. I mean, I'm already gone. Yeah, I don't actually care about going to either one, but I'd go to Arizona for that weekend. You're going to go?
I'm just saying it, but yeah, I'm actually going to try to make an attempt with whoever wants to go.
All right. I could be down.
I had FOMO just from the LA weekend. And I know one of you feels differently about the Super Bowl being in LA, but I thought that it being there the whole week just looked like awesome lead up of events, and anyone who's anyone is there. And I just had this like FOMO and wish I was there.
So that was me. I kind of thought, as great as it was to see all these celebrities and everyone in attendance for the Super Bowl, and the halftime show obviously was amazing, but I heard from multiple people that were there that, you know, people that have been to a bunch of Super Bowls, I guess, that being in LA for the Super Bowl didn't really have the same impact that normal Super Bowls have, because usually
it's
like
so when spread out.
Went up on the Super Bowl. Yeah, that too. Like, so there was the Super Bowl party was like downtown LA by the crypto.com arena. And, you know, usually it's right outside the stadium and all that stuff. So people have to like go back and forth, like the Super Bowl partying to the actual stadium, which is in Inglewood. But like, you know, when you think about a Super Bowl in Indianapolis, where there isn't much happening around the city, like the entire city is all about the Super Bowl. Like in LA, I think, you know, the Kings had games still and the Lakers had games still. I know the Clippers were playing. So like, you know, the entire city isn't really focused on arguably the, well, probably the biggest event in sports. So, you know, I think there is a case to be made where, you know, if the Super Bowl is in a city like, you know, Indianapolis or Houston that maybe don't have so many other things going on, that the entire city can actually focus on this like one event.
Yeah, it's your first good point of
the entire podcast history
of this season. I was just saying this season of the locker room. I see both sides. I feel like if it's in Indianapolis, like you're bumping into people more and like you just sort of feel the vibe on the street. But then, you know, the celebrities and influencers these days were all there, so it goes both ways. What one of you were just about to say something?
No, I definitely agree. But Laz, let's be real. If the Rams gave Dave their due diligence and let him perform, you'd be saying this is the best Super Bowl of all time. Love this.
I still thought it was amazing. I'm just saying like the actual impact of the event, I think it has more significance if it's in a city that doesn't necessarily get those big kind of things. You know,
I'm just fucking with you. I understand.
No, I completely agree. I thought it was amazing. I mean, it didn't make a difference to me. I wasn't fucking there, but the people that actually go to the Super Bowl every year, that's the feedback I got.
Yeah. Regardless, I mean, a lot of people were just like, I mean, first off, a lot of bets were going through for the Bengals. I'm sure you guys noticed, like they were just the betting favorite. Everybody wanted Joe Burrow to win, which I found like I understood that, but at the same time, it's like, man, give Stafford his due diligence, man. The guy earned it. He fucking deserves that championship. Like, I don't give a fuck what anybody says. Like, Burrow's young. He will be back there, like without a doubt in my mind. Like,
we said about Rodgers.
No, not even that. You said it about Rodgers, yes, but like I believe it. You know, maybe he won't, but regardless, he's young. He has time. Stafford with the whole just debacle with the Lions, like to come out on top and have a championship, man, like unreal for him. Unreal for Cooper Kupp. Like I mean, I'm with you guys in the sense of like I think parade was kind of like half-assed compared to some of the other parades. It didn't look like it was like bumping as it should be. Even the speech that Whitworth gave, like he was talking about Cooper Kupp and just like his work ethic and like how he basically like. The guy's the MVP of the fucking Super Bowl, and he came from nothing. This guy wasn't a five-star recruit. He wasn't anything. And, like, man, like, the shit like that just gives me fucking chills, man. I love stuff like that, stories like that. It's good to hear.
Yeah, dude. And speaking of chills, as you're listening to this, the game's over, but USA versus Canada, women's gold medal game, you know, the game everyone gets up for every 4 years because these teams always seem to meet in the gold medal game in the Olympics and pretty much any international hockey tournament. But, you know, we're obviously recording before the game starts. It's on 11:10 tonight, you know, so we can't really talk about the game itself, but I'm very excited to stay up and watch. I mean, it's always really fun to watch these two teams compete. You know, the women don't necessarily hate each other, but there is a rivalry. I mean, a lot of them play together, so it's not like there's this built up hate, but whenever USA and Canada play each other in any stage, it's incredible. So if you didn't watch because you're listening after the game, highly recommend whenever the women play each other that you watch next time, because I'm sure this game's gonna be awesome. Brett, you had something to say. What's going on?
Well, it's a true rivalry that you don't see that much in any sports. One, because it's every 4 years, but yeah. So the last five Olympic finals has been USA and Canada, maybe more, but I know at least five. There hasn't been a single other team in the finals, so there's not much in sports that you can say it's two titans every single year going.
Just Cavs Warriors.
Yeah, for a minute. Yeah. Yeah.
And kudos to the Olympics, and I think they do that well from a sense of they realize, especially from the woman's side of hockey, that USA and Canada are the two top programs and the two powerhouses, so that they don't have them meet in the semis or quarterfinals and eliminate one of them, so that they can make this gold medal game like that much more anticipated and that much more highly regarded. Like, it's smart that they do that because it would just be upsetting for a blowout in the finals. But on a sore note, from the men's side, USA men's and Canadian men's both eliminated, which is just tough look for both those organizations, in my opinion. Even though, I mean, the hockey's tremendous in Sweden, you know, all the other countries that knocked them off. But, I mean, you hate to see it. You obviously hate to see it.
Actually, a throwback name. I saw a really cool video today. Miro Šatan, former Islander. He's Slovakian. He posted a video on Twitter today of, like, his youth hockey team all gathered around watching the end of the game on a phone. It was really a really cute video of these like little kids literally celebrating like they just won the Stanley Cup in Slovakia, watching Slovakia beat the U.S. So there is some good to come out of it. But, you know, I thought that was like a really cool video. And that's what the Olympics are all about, right? Like everyone having pride for their country. And, you know, these little, like I remember being in ninth grade at the rink, like everyone walked outside to the lobby to watch the end of the USA versus Canada when Zach Parise tied it up with like 20 seconds left and then Crosby had the gold medal game. But like literally everyone was in full gear, not even concerned about our own game, just watching it on TV together. Like that's the coolest part about the Olympics, you know?
No doubt.
In the Olympics.
But I think that's going to wrap it up for the intro. We got a great interview with Stan Fischler. Let's send it over to him. Hope you guys enjoy it. This guy grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and is a legend in all aspects of the word. He covered the Rangers, Islanders, and Devils for many years and has written a ton of books and most recently published his book called The Tales of Brooklyn. He was recently inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, and it's an honor to have him here. I've been watching him on TV and listening to him my entire life. So welcome to the Locker Room Podcast, Stan Fischler. Stan, what's going on?
What's going on? A lot of hockey is going on. I got a new book out, Tales from Brooklyn. It's available on Amazon, and I'm very, very busy writing.
You're still writing more now?
Well, I do a piece, three pieces a week for the hockey news. I do a piece every week, a historic piece for the Devils, another historic piece for the Islanders. And I do a piece every Wednesday for NHL.com, which is a historic piece.
So how late up at night are you staying up over there? I know you're in Israel right now. You've been there.
I get up early and I try to go to bed early. I usually get up about 6 a.m. and I try to be in bed by 9 p.m.
Well, I won't keep you up too late tonight. I know it's 7 p.m. there right now. But can you kind of rewind and tell us what brought you to Israel in the first place? You've been there for a couple of years, no?
That's right. Well, I pretty much set a date for retirement. After my wife died a little more than 6 years ago.
Very sorry.
And once she died, I was alone in Manhattan and I was winding down my career with MSG Networks. I was doing Islander games, which I had been doing since 1975. And I decided, I told my boss that this will be my final year. And I thought my oldest son lives in Portland, Oregon, and my youngest son lives in Israel. Mm-hmm. And I decided, because I'm a Zionist, that I would move to Israel. And I've been here going on at least 3.5 years living in the North Golan Heights, which is what I call the Jewish Montana. very much like the state of Montana, big sky, not too crowded, and lots of cattle.
You must have a nice tan.
Well, this is the rainy snow season. We had a blizzard about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Dumped 16 inches of snow, and it's been cold. This morning, last night was very cold. It was below freezing. This is the way it is in the Golan. Skiing in the Mount Hermon, the big mountain. This morning was interesting because I do my prayers in the morning, and I usually stay inside during the winter, but the sun was out. And when the sun's out here, because we're 3,000 feet over sea level, it was actually nice and warm in the sun.
What do you like to do for activity when you get outside, or do you just kind of hang out?
Well,
you
know? When it's warmer, I ride my bike around the perimeter of the kibbutz for about an hour. It's four times around. And that's my main physical activity. Mm-hmm. I do some walking, but I prefer the bike. But I haven't been on the bike since the beginning of November, so it's like ancient history. I have a stationary bike in the here, and I've been using that lately.
What, a Peloton?
Pardon?
A Peloton?
What is that?
Oh, it's like the new the hip bike. It's like, I guess there's like a screen on the bike, and you have an instructor.
Well, I read a book, or I just look outside.
Mm-hmm. Not a bad view, I'm sure.
Well, it's very convenient. I never knew I could read a book while being on that, and I just started this year. Actually, it's kind of neat.
Yeah, no, that sounds really cool. I always had a dream of moving to Tel Aviv and teaching hockey and coaching hockey. Can you kind of talk about the popularity of hockey down in Israel? I mean, I know there are a lot of players.
It's been hockey here for quite a while. Roger Nielsen, when he was coaching the Flyers, actually had a summer hockey camp here for a couple of summers. In fact, there's a plaque honoring him in the rink. It's called the Canada Center. It's about 45-minute drive from where I am now in the town of Matula. Mm-hmm. It's an Olympic-sized rink. And there is a big rink about a two-hour drive away called One Ice. It's only a few years old, maybe 4 years old. Beautiful rink. Actually, it has a smaller rink too, so it's like a rink and a three-quarters of another one.
I've played there before.
A couple of other small rinks around. My kids, my three grandchildren, one is now 17. She's in high school. She's not playing anymore. But my other grandchildren, Avigail is just 13. She's a real good defenseman. And my grandson, Ariel, who is 15. My son, Simon, felt they weren't getting enough good training here in Israel. Mm-hmm. And he's in Switzerland with them. The hockey here is still, there's still plenty of people playing the game. The problem is if you're a very good hockey player, like my two grandchildren, you're limited in terms of how much you can progress. Mm-hmm. And Simon felt that they weren't getting the kind of instruction they have. And since they're both gifted, he decided to see how it would be in Switzerland. He's very fond of Switzerland. He's been there many times. And they're in a town called Thun, Thun, which is right next to Bern. Mm. They've been playing well. They've been playing, they're playing with Swiss kids. The girl who's playing with boys is very advanced and plays very tough, has natural instincts. They've already told my son that if she keeps up the way she's going, she'll be on the Swiss national team.
Yeah,
I think they mean the girls team, but she's very good. And the boy works very hard at it. He's not as natural. Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I didn't realize my...
No, it's okay. It's okay.
So they're likely going to continue in Switzerland. And so far, so good.
Isn't Bern where Austin Matthews played that 1 year of pro before his draft year?
You're right. You're right. That's true. They at first thought that the kids would play on the Bern team for their age. Mm-hmm. But my son thought it would be better to play at a one level below. And the Thun team fits them. Thun, as I said, is right next door to Bern. And mm-hmm. if things go well, then they'll wind up with Bern. That's the aim right now.
So playing in college is not in the question?
What?
Playing in college in the United States is not in the question?
nothing is out of the question. They have to be, you know, they have to be scouted. Mm-hmm. And look, that's a possibility. A scholarship would be very good, but that's getting ahead of the game right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're still very young. But I mean, parents and grandparents now, I mean, you know, my parents started talking about a scholarship when I was like 11 years old.
Well, you know, there's a money factor involved. Hockey is the most expensive sport. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. Not easy at all.
See you. Take care of your room is ready.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good time. Drive, drive safe. The question is always, you know, can we afford this? Mm-hmm. Him going to Switzerland, you got to pay. You know, there's airfare, there's all kinds of issues, but we're doing the best we can.
Yeah. And I know we kind of talked about, you know, through email a little bit the last week, just, you know, my background and your background and how we both kind of felt that the Jewish community was very similar to the hockey community. You can obviously touch on it a little more than I can. I've, you know, started to learn about it in the last like 2 years or so, but, you know, I've always felt in hockey that everyone kind of knows everyone, and it's somewhat of a tight fraternity, and so is being Jewish. Can you kind of touch on that and your experience and the relationships you've built and just, you know, comparing the two?
I've been with hockey my whole life, going back to 1939. I saw my first game in 1939, I was seven. And my experience has always been, I've said this before, that hockey is the Jew of sports. The Jews have been underdogs. Hockey compared to football, to basketball, to baseball, is the underdog of the four major sports. It's always been that way because it's originally considered Canada's game. Mm-hmm. And it's by the media has always viewed it as Canada's game. And that's changed. It changed a little bit in 1960 when we won a gold medal with amateurs, Squaw Valley. It changed again in 1980 when we won another gold medal with amateurs, which is the way I think it always should be, by the way.
Oh, really?
In Lake Placid. Mm-hmm. And we've got amateurs now in China. We beat Canada today 4-2. Mm-hmm. Now, America is developing hockey players. USA Hockey has been a tremendous asset. And you got players coming from places where you'd never expect. Austin Matthews from Arizona. Mm-hmm. Never heard of that. Then we got guys in California from some very, very small communities down south. The point is now, if you have a rink, they'll play. And we see that right here in Israel. I mean, lots and lots of kids play, but you have to have rink and you have to be able to afford it. You know, it's not like here. Here it's very different. You know, when in the city, if you break a stick, you go down to one of the hockey stores and you get a new stick. If you break a stick here, you got to hope that some comes in the mail from the States. It's a different scene.
Yeah. And you break a stick, you're spending $300 to $400 now when I'm 10 years ago.
That's one of the, fortunately, the guy who publishes the Hockey News, Graham Ralston, he bought a couple of Canadian stick companies, and he is able to sell a stick for less than $100. Mm-hmm. And if you read the Hockey News, you could see what he's doing. It's a very, very significant, because a lot of kids break a stick, you can't afford another one.
Yeah, and kids don't really. I didn't understand the value of a dollar when I was a kid, so. You know, I remember in practice growing up, there were plenty of kids who were just like, oh, that new Bauer stick came out. I really want it. I'm going to break my stick in practice when my dad's not looking.
Right.
I was one of those kids. I used to tell my dad the blade broke in practice during a drill, but I would just step on it. I'm sure he didn't appreciate that.
I don't appreciate the cost of hockey sticks.
Oh, definitely not. And now that I'm done playing,
when I was playing, I bought my first stick was a Lovell, mm-hmm. L-O-V-E-L-L. It was made in Erie, Pennsylvania.
That's where I went to school.
I think I paid either a buck and a quarter or a buck and a half, which was good money then. Mm-hmm. It lasted down to being a splinter. It never broke. The Northland Pros were good too, wood sticks. But I don't want to get into the stick business because it gets me sick when I think about it.
Okay, well, we'll transition then. Let's talk about that first game that you mentioned, 1939. Where did the love for hockey first develop? Was it like right away? You're 7 years old, you know, and you just fell in love with it as soon as.
In my book, Tales of Brooklyn, you can get from Amazon.
Mm-hmm. I just started it 2 days ago, by the way. Thank you for sending that to me.
In the book, I tell the story. It's a whole chapter. In 1939, the big children's movie that was a must-see was called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was the first full-length Disney cartoon-type movie. Sort of like Star Wars became, every kid had to see it. So my father said, I'm going to take you to see it on a Sunday afternoon at the Globe Theater, which was in Times Square. Mm-hmm. We took off from my house in Williamsburg, took the subway. And when we left, it was sunny, which is Sunday afternoon. And when we got off the subway at 50th and 8th, it was pouring. It was a real downpour. You know what a Hollywood rain is?
I don't.
Hollywood rain is when the rain, Hollywood never learned how to make realistic rain. Every rain in a Hollywood movie is a sheet. Mm-hmm. It's never a drizzle. But this was a real Hollywood rain. It was coming down in torrents. We didn't have an umbrella. And we were right at the corner of 50th and 8th. You know what's on the corner? What was on the corner of 50th and 8th?
Was it Madison Square Garden?
That's right, mm-hmm. My old Madison Square Garden. And my father looked at the rain, looked at the marquee. There was hockey, not the Rangers. It was a doubleheader. They had a Met League game at 1:30 and the Rovers game at 3:30. Rovers were the Ranger farm team. Mm-hmm. And my father said, I'm sorry, we're not going to go see Snow White. I'm going to take you to see the hockey game. I didn't know what the hell hockey was, and I started to cry. My father never gave in to me issues like that, and he yanked me into the garden, and I was furious. I was crying. I wanted to go to. I didn't know what the hell this was. I would get in there, but there was no getting out, so I had to figure out what to do. And I realized that, first of all, my father was rooting for the home team, the Rovers. So I immediately decided to root for the other team, which was Washington Eagles. That was the name of the team. Mm-hmm. And they had nice uniforms with a big eagle on the front. And as the game progressed, I saw that one of the guys on Washington reminded me of my radio hero, which was the Lone Ranger. And I followed him more than the others. And it turned out that he was the star. His name was Normie Burns. He later got a crack at the Rangers, by the way. And he was great. He scored a hat trick.
Oh, wow.
And not only did he score a hat trick, but my team beat my father's team. So I was feeling really good about this.
Mm-hmm. Did you bet any money on it?
Next day, I'm at PS 54 and my third grade teacher, Mrs. Gould, did a thing called show and tell. Mm-hmm. You know what show and tell is?
Of course I do.
Okay, so she called on me, and I decided I was going to do the goalie, because the goalie fascinated me. In those days, goalies didn't wear masks, and mm-hmm. they were more real. And I did the goalie, and Mrs. Gould gave me an A. And I said, boy, this hockey isn't bad after all. So came Saturday, and Father took me to see Snow White. And on the subway home, I said, Dad, you think we can go to see another hockey game? And he said, sure. And the next day, we went to see the Rovers play the Baltimore Orioles. And I never stopped going to a hockey after that.
So when did you see the first your first Rangers game?
I wasn't allowed to see the Rangers because the Rangers started at 8:30 at night.
Ah, past the bedtime.
And that meant I would have to get up for school early and wouldn't have enough sleep. So I was not allowed until 42 when I was 10. Mm-hmm. And in November, and I went with my father, took me to see the Rangers and the Blackhawks. I was gifted after I made it to the U.S. Hall of Fame. I was honored by the Rangers, and they actually gave me a copy of the scorecard, the whole everything on who scored, in addition to other things as a gift. So that was my first game. And of course, it was exciting, mm-hmm. but I didn't see another Ranger game until 46, March 46. By that time, I was a Maple Leaf fan. I became a Maple Leaf fan when I was that year, 10, when I was 10, for different reasons. And my father took me to see in March 46 to see the Rangers and the Maple Leafs. And starting the next season, which was October 46, I started to go to all the Ranger games. Mm-hmm. And I was a Maple Leaf fan, so obviously I never missed a Maple Leaf game. And that was it. That's how it, that was the stepping stones to never missing a Ranger game.
Well, I also know we talked
By the way, I didn't stop going to the Rover games. Mm-hmm. I was going going every single Sunday when I was able to go alone, which was about 2 years later after those first two games. I went to every single Rover doubleheader. That was some of the best hockey I ever saw. Was in fact, this is Black History Month. And I was just writing about, I saw the first all-black forward line at the Garden. Years before Willie O'Ree, the Rovers used to have an interlocking schedule with the Quebec Senior Hockey League, which was mm-hmm. very good hockey. And two black guys were brothers, Ozzie Carnegie and Herbie Carnegie, and another black guy, Manny McIntyre. They comprised the forward line with the Sherbrooke Saints, and they came down, played the Rovers, and they were fantastic. Seeing an all-black line, and they were great. They were great. Herbie should have made it to the NHL. That's a whole other story. They were great during the war, 42, 43, 43, 44, the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, had a wonderful team made up of former NHL players who enlisted, Johnny Mariucci, who was from the Blackhawks, Art Coulter, who was the captain of the Rangers when they won the Cup in 40. Oh, a whole bunch. It was great, great, great hockey. Like I said, the Rover games meant as much to me as any Ranger game.
No, that's really cool. I never heard that before. I actually have heard the name Manny McIntyre before, though. I don't know where I've heard that name. But
Heard what name?
I've heard the name Manny McIntyre before. That sounds very familiar.
Funny because everybody else would say they knew the Carnegies because as I said, Herbie Carnegie was NHL quality, mm-hmm. but it didn't happen. It was partly his own fault and partly the fact that they weren't paying much dough. But that's I said, it's another story.
Well, someone else I want to talk about that we kind of touched on, you know, on the phone last week. Hi Bueller, you said played for the Rangers in the 50s and that he reminds you of Adam Fox today. Can you talk about the comparison between those two?
Well, Hi Bueller grew up in Montreal, mm-hmm. was very, very gifted teenager. He wound up playing junior hockey in Saskatoon. And in 1942, he came to New York and he played for the Rovers. I saw him. Hi Bueller playing for the Rovers. They had another Jewish player named Max Labovich, who was from Winnipeg, who only played one game with the Rangers. But Hi Bueller was not, he went actually from the Rovers to the Red Wings. And in the late 40s, early 50s, he was playing in the American League for the Cleveland Barons. He was a great, he was terrific. And the Rangers that had an arrangement with Cleveland, they'd bring, they'd make a deal with the Barons. Cleveland was run like a major league team. And High Bullock came to the Rangers a good 10 years after I saw him as a Rover. And he made the second All-Star team as a rookie. He was an excellent defenseman, two-way defenseman, very much like Adam Fox is now. He made an impact immediately. Unfortunately, the team was not a playoff team, but he was a very good player. I became friendly with him, and I think he played 4 or 5 years NHL. He died very not long after he retired. He passed away.
It's sad. So on the topic of Adam Fox, I mean, as someone who grew up with the game of hockey like yourself, how cool is it for you to see, you know, 5 to 10 Jewish players in the NHL today that are actually impactful, like very good hockey players, you know, not just there, you know, on the cusp, but actually making a difference in the league?
First of all, I used to dream of being an NHL player. I want to be a goalie. That ended pretty quickly. But the idea of somebody from the New York area making it into the NHL was unheard of. Mm-hmm. It just didn't happen. Now, oddly enough, I just did a piece for NHL.com this past Wednesday. There was somebody from New York who made it to the NHL as far back as 1941. And you'll never guess who that is.
Nope.
Referee, Bill Chadwick. Bill Chadwick is a Hall of Fame referee. And he made it to the NHL, but as far as a player, it was unheard of because we only had a couple of rinks in New York and didn't really cater much to hockey. Mm-hmm. So when Nicky Fatiu made it to the Rangers from Staten Island, that was a big deal.
I know that name.
A very good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And now we get guys like the Mullen brothers. Joey Mullen made it to the Hall of Fame right out of Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan.
Brian Mullen was my coach.
Adam Fox is an example of a player who grew up in the New York area and all he needed was ice. He got ice. He made it to juniors right to Harvard, played for Harvard. The miracle is that the Rangers got him because he was drafted by Calgary. And then they traded him to Carolina and they let him go. And lo and behold, he winds up not only with the Rangers, but the star. In fact, I said he should be the captain. Now, the fact that he's a Jewish player making it makes me even more proud. Mm-hmm. And because we know that there are other Jewish players in the league. And some of them have done very well. But I look at Fox and then I think of High Buller. And I did a story for NHL.com called Then and Now, comparing them to the two. When I did it, Fox had not emerged as the star he is now. After all, he won the Norris Trophy as best defenseman. But very nice to see. Very nice to see Jewish players do well.
Yeah, Adam was the first ever player of Jewish descent to win a major award in the NHL.
Mm-hmm. That's
very
right.
Cool. Very cool.
But he deserved it. He deserved mm-hmm. it. He was quite the player.
Yeah, no, 100%. And when, like, you know, someone who's been in media for such a long time, do you ever wish that you know, your career was in this day and age with the way media works now, or are you kind of, you know,
not at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like you wouldn't want it.
I am very, very happy. I worked with when players didn't wear helmets, goalies didn't wear masks. It was pure hockey. Yeah, it was like hockey that we used to do, you know, when we went outside and played roller hockey or even ice hockey in Central Park Lake when it froze. No helmets, no mask, you know, but so I started watching in 39, and it wasn't until 1959 that the first goalie put on a mask, which was Jacques Plante. And that disturbed me no end, no end when he put the mask on. And there were, helmets didn't come into vogue until much later than that, in 68. So I was watching this pure hockey, no goalies with men. After Plant put on the mask, it was a long time before others did. And it was a different, players were more approachable. There was no union, no agents, none of that, all that stuff. And not that I don't like it now. I've made the adjustment, but it was a different thing. And I'm so happy that I was able to, I can tell people stories that they can't believe about the way it was then. But it's like the difference in cars. If you bought a Cadillac in 1939, it wouldn't match with today's Caddy. It's different. Everything's different.
Well, which decade was your favorite decade of hockey?
What?
Which decade was your favorite?
Well, every decade was a favorite in a different way because of the circumstances. You know, it's like somebody, I love this story. A guy was interviewing Bobby Orr when he was in his prime. And the reporter went up to Parry Sound, Ontario, which during the summer, and he interviewed Bobby Orr's mother. And the reporter said, "What do you think of how well your son is doing?" And she said, "Which one?" Because she loved both her sons. Mm-hmm. Well, I look at the eras with affection because each era had its own particular qualities. And obviously, one of the things I always yearned for was the ability to be there when a Stanley Cup was won. Well, that took a long time. It wasn't until the Canadians had their run in the 50s where I was able to see a cup-winning game. Mm-hmm. And of course, then there was the fact that the Rangers finally won a cup, but the Islanders had won four straight, and I was covering them. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
Imagine 19 consecutive playoff series victories. And by the way, I don't see any Islander jerseys here. What? Why not?
I'm a Ranger fan. I'm not an Islander fan.
But you're doing hockey. You could be ecumenical about it, you know.
I don't not like the Islanders. I just root for the Rangers.
No, I get it. I get it. 19 straight playoff series victories doesn't mean anything to you, right?
No, it definitely does. I mean, that's unheard of, and I don't think it'll ever happen again.
When the Rangers are able to do that, you let me know, okay?
It'll never happen again. I don't think anyone will ever do it.
Damn right it won't. So the island, covering the Islanders, then in 1995, the Devils won the Cup, and I covered them. Mm-hmm. And then the Devils won the Cup in 2000, I covered them. And then the Devils won the Cup again in 2003, and I covered them. These are all phenomenal experiences. And, I could go on and on. I've covered one of the longest hockey games ever played. It was the Easter Epic Islanders, if you don't mind my mentioning them again.
No, of course. Was it Pat LaFontaine?
The Islanders against Washington, and LaFontaine scored the winner at about 1 a.m. And another one was the great Devils Buffalo game, Hašek versus Brodeur, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, all of these things are part of loving the game.
I don't know if you've had the chance to go because you've been in Israel, but have you walked into UBS Arena yet?
About what?
Have you been to UBS Arena, the Islanders' new home rink?
I was there for the opener on November 20th against Calgary. I was there the next night against Toronto. And I was there the following Wednesday when they played the Rangers.
So what do you think of the modern day NHL arena?
Well, the UBS Arena is the most beautiful arena in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's got everything.
It's spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, everything about it is special. Even the gift shop, which is very big, they don't have schlock stuff like Formica tables. Everything is antique, very, very... Every nuance in the building is very, very special. I've never seen anything like
it. I mean, that building is, it's so great for hockey on Long Island too. You know, it's such a great place to be, and it's nice the Islanders finally have like a beautiful home, because I feel like that's, you know, been long overdue.
We missed the Coliseum.
Yeah.
The Coliseum was the most special American arena in terms of the fans, in terms of the sight lines being perfect, the sound as an arena. When it opened in 72, Clarence Campbell was president of the NHL, and he went to the arena just before it opened. He looked around, he said, this is the best arena in the league. And it was the best arena in the league until it closed.
Yeah, no, I loved going there as a kid, and even last year in the playoff run, it was a lot of fun going to those games. But Stan, before I let you go, because I know we're kind of, you know, getting close to time here, I do want to ask one last time about Tales of Brooklyn and kind of, you know, what inspired you to tell the story at this moment of time?
Well, there were 35 stories, and the way the book came about was really extraordinary. And it has a hockey background. I did Devil Games for a long, long time on TV, MS First Sports Channel and then MSG Network. And I worked a long time with Glenn Chico Resch, former Devil Islanders goalie and Devils goalie and Flyers goalie. We became very good friends. We are very close. And on our road trips, we'd be spending times together, and he had a very unusual fascination with my hometown, which is Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm much older than Glenn, I was able to tell stories about growing up in Brooklyn. And the story that he liked best was about it was December 28th, 1947. It was right after Christmas. And I was from a family that loved ice cream. Ice cream was like very, 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 very special. And my Aunt Hattie, my mother's kid sister, was the great ice cream maven.
Mm-hmm.
She lived in Albany and she used to come visit all the time. And she came down just after Christmas. And this is the story that I told Glenn, and it was about a blizzard. We had it was the biggest snowstorm in the history of New York City by feet. It began the day after Christmas, which was December 26th, and it kept on and on and on. So normally we had two refrigerators with ice cream in the house because we lived on the third floor. My grandparents on the first floor, my Aunt Helen on the middle floor. So there was a refrigerator on the top. And so by the second day, my Aunt Hattie, who was the one who was the real ice cream maven, discovered we ran out of ice cream. This was a very, very traumatic moment. You had to have ice cream, right?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
In the meantime, the blizzard had shut down Brooklyn. The blizzard made Brooklyn like Montana. Cars marooned in the streets. And she says, Stanley, I want you to go get ice cream. Here's $5. Well, that sounded great because I loved being out in the snow, loved ice cream. And it was a challenge because I had to find a place that sold ice cream, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I walked out and I'm schlepping and schlepping and everything was closed. And now it's not fun anymore. I walked all the way to the Williamsburg Bridge and nothing. And then I walked underneath the Broadway Brooklyn L and nothing. And finally, I saw one place. There was a light. And It was a candy store that was open. It's a miracle. So I got the ice cream, schlepped back, and I tell you, I almost thought I wasn't going to make it. That's how tough it was.
What flavor did you get, if you don't mind me asking?
But I was exhausted. I come back into the house, and I brown paper bag, of course, was all wet, practically falling apart. And I put it on the kitchen table on my grandmother's kitchen. And then I walked back into the vestibule, took off my galoshes, took off my Mackinac, and I hear a sound, a very strange sound from the kitchen. But it wasn't a good sound. It was very hard to describe. It wasn't, it was a sound of unhappiness, the best I could put it then. Mm-hmm. And finally, I go back into the house, and there's my Aunt Hattie standing over the brown paper bag, which already is open, looks at me, and she yells at me, "You mean you got reeds?" Well, there were four ice creams of quality: Breyers, Seal Test, Borden's, and Horton's. And the one at the bottom of the list, like Thunderbird wine is to champagne, Reed's was to Breyers. And she took the quart container and tossed it in the garbage. Now, that wasn't funny then.
Of course not. Yeah, definitely not.
I was crushed. Uh-huh. I was crushed. Now, in retrospect, decades and decades later, when I look back, well, Aunt Hattie was a connoisseur. And she was reacting as a connoisseur would. This is crap ice cream. So what's my point? The point is, when I told that story to Chico, somehow or other, he thought this was one of the great stories that he ever heard. And he would ask me regularly, "Would you tell that Aunt Hattie story again?" And through the years, I would tell it to him. So about a year and a half ago, he sent me an email. He said, "My wife, Diane, would like you to write down the story and send it to her." So I did. And about 3 days later, I get a letter back from Diane Resch. She loved the ice cream story and Aunt Hattie. "Can you send me another story about growing up in Brooklyn?"
And there it is.
Oh, that was easy. Mm-hmm. Any one of the many that I had in my memory, because I had a great, very keen memory for what happened a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I sent the second piece to her. And she wrote back, "Boy, this is terrific. Can you send me another one?" "Ah, yeah, I like these stories. What the?" And, you know, I'm knocking them off in my spare time. You know, it's like I'm doing my hockey stuff. And then if I have the energy, I'd start thinking. Usually take me about 4 days, the idea, then crafting it, then editing it, and then, you know, sending it out. Mm-hmm. So now she asked me for a fourth one. So I wrote a fourth one, and I said, "What the hell am I doing?" To her, why don't I send it to friends, guys I grew up with? And I'm getting responses. They like the stuff. I began to send it to more and more people. And finally, after the 20th one, I sent a few to my literary agent, Doug Whiteman. Mm-hmm. And he read them, and he said to me, he wrote back, he says, "If you can do a total of 30, I think we got a book here." So I actually got up to 35, which are in the book. And you got the book.
Yeah, I have it in my room.
You have it?
Yeah, I have it in my room. I got it 2 days ago. I started it yesterday.
Okay. Well, you can tell your friends about it.
I will. And I'll be reaching out to you after I read each story.
And you'll see the ice cream story. It's right there. Of course, I tell about it in the foreword. So that's how it happened. And once I really got going, I felt this is a story that my grandkids should have, and my son Ben and my son Simon. and good friends who now it so happens that when I was growing up in Brooklyn, my best friend was a guy named Howie Spara. And I've got a lot of stories involving Howie, including how once we almost kidnapped a Brooklyn trolley. And and I got a lot of baseball, Brooklyn Dodgers stuff, including the best Dodger game I ever saw with Howie in 42, Cardinals, Dodgers at Ebbets Field. Mort Cooper, 20-game winner for St. Louis, and Whitlow Wire, 20-game winner for Brooklyn. Zip, zip into the top of the ninth. I was rooting for the Cardinals, by the way. And Whitey Kurowski hits one into the lower left field stands, and the Dodgers lost 1-0, and my guys won 1-0. It was great. Beautiful, perfect baseball day. And I got a lot of hockey in it, obviously, and including some of the stories that I've told you, like the Snow White story.
Yeah. I got to ask you what flavor ice cream you got.
You know, what?
You didn't tell me the flavor ice cream that you got and the ice cream story.
It's always chocolate.
Chocolate?
Yeah. None of this phony stuff they have now. They throw all kinds of crap in it. pure stuff.
I was a mint chocolate chip guy myself.
The only thing exotic that we would get would be what they call it, vanilla fudge or something like that. It was a good Breyers ice cream. Of course, we could get ice cream in bulk then, not necessarily in the the containers. But yeah, the ice cream story is just great.
Yeah, no, that was a great story.
I have mixed feelings. I commend my Aunt Hattie, and then I deplore. Well, I deplored it at the time because I was about to plot. It was a tough run.
Well, before I let you go, I do got one more question for you. If you can go back and give the 15-year-old version of yourself some advice, what would you tell him? If you can give the 15-year-old you advice, what would you tell him?
Well, when I was seven, which was in 39, after I'd seen my first hockey games, I went to the Brooklyn Public Library, the Tompkins Park branch. It was a very small library in the middle of Tompkins Park, which was about a 5-minute walk. And I've always said it was all on one floor. It was a round building, one floor. And I always felt that I thought that it had 50 stories underneath, because anytime I wanted a book, they had it. And the first hockey book that I ever saw was at the Tompkins Park Library. It was written in 1938 by Red Dutton, who was the coach and manager of the New York Americans, which was the second team in the NHL, actually before the Rangers by a year. And the book was simply called Hockey, the World's Fastest Sport. And at the beginning of the book, very first chapter, two words. And at the very end of the book, two words. And the two words was Red Dutton's advice: keep punching, keep punching. And I've told that to many people when they're in tough situations. And it's not always easy to follow through, and I've given that advice to my 15-year-old grandson who plays.
That's simple, but it works. I mean, you know, everyone kind of goes through it, and all you can do is just keep moving forward, keep punching. So it makes sense. But Stan, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's been literally an honor to talk to you, and I also want to thank you because I did meet you when I was around 10 years old at Cosby's outside of MSG. And I was with my dad before a Rangers game, and you signed a picture for me and gave me a book. And, I think he said, keep going or keep punching, whatever it was, I think, back then. So,
That was a landmark.
It was. Cosby
went back to the 40s. Mm-hmm. And the last Cosby store, which, by the way, is no longer there.
Yeah.
It went down with the riots. Was a hockey haven. It was a great hangout before a game.
That's where everyone met before the Rangers games. Meet me at Cosby's.
My buddy Mike Cosby ran it. And I used to have book signings there a lot. Love the place.
Yeah.
Really love the place. But no longer there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it myself. And I never tire of telling the Ann Hattie story. But that's how the book came about.
Yeah. No, yeah.
If Chico hadn't told the story to his wife, Diane, and Diane hadn't said to me, can you write that story down and send it to me? There never would have been a book.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. It's crazy how it works.
If enough of your friends buy it, I'm going to do another book.
I will. I will definitely spread the word. And I seriously, I want to thank you again. I hope we can stay in touch. It'd be great to meet someday.
Okay, I'll be in touch and hope next time we do the show, I can send you an island to Jersey.
Okay, deal. You got a deal.
It won't hurt a bit.
That's fair. I'll hang it up right here for you. I want to thank Stan Fischer once again for joining the show. Literally such an honor to talk to an NHL legend. And go check out his new book, Tales of Brooklyn. He is one of the best storytellers in the game of hockey and someone I've been looking up to for a very long time. So it was really cool to finally chat with him face to face. That's going to wrap it up for this week's episode. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Mindset Wellness. I seriously cannot talk about how much I love this company. Mindset Wellness CBD, as you can see, I'm holding the happy gummies right here. They go really nice with my little happy hat from the Happiness Project, but I'm almost out of my, I'm almost out of my happiness gummies. I take these things every day, try to take two a day just to get in the best mood possible, whether I'm stuck at work, stuck on the train, commuting, whatever it is may be, the weather's not nice out. The happy gummies definitely make my day a little bit better. So go to mindsetwellness.com, use code LATKE20, that's LATKE20, for 20% off your order, plus free shipping, and check them out on Instagram at mindsetwellnessCBD. I seriously cannot recommend another CBD company more than Mindset Wellness. They saved my life. I use them literally every day, whether it's happy, calm, rest, beauty, anything, you name it, they've got it all. So go check out mindsetwellness.com and use our code. That's going to wrap it up for this week's episode. We got another one coming for you next week. We love you guys and thank you for listening and talk to you soon.